Welcome to the latest episode of Oncology on the Go. I'm your host, Ariana Pelosi. Today's episode focuses on the themes of survivorship and supportive care in oncology. This includes important topics like nutrition, oncodermatology, body image, sexual health, and mortality. We spoke with Declan Walsh, Denise Reynolds, Adam Friedman, Daniel C. McFarland, Michelle Fingerette, Christian Nelson, and William Breitbart regarding these sensitive issues. These topics, which should be integrated into oncology care, give a brief glimpse into a large conversation on multidisciplinary and patient-centered care. Dr. Walsh, what is the importance of developing and managing supportive care at major oncology centers, and how can it be adapted across the U.S.?
Based on the experience, we feel that what we've seen here is transferable and scalable to other cancer centers, not just the United States, but internationally. And we would hope that this will become the standard of care over the next, decade or so, realistically. One important point to make is that many cancer centers already have a lot of supportive services being provided. So, for example, counseling, support groups, nutrition, palliative care for cancer patients, but they're not organized in a cohesive fashion, in a cohesive manner. And they're not necessarily readily accessible to patients. And I think the insight that we had here was that we could restructure, reorganize, and coordinate these services and programs much more effectively within a formal department of supportive oncology, in the same way that you would have a department of radiation oncology or surgical oncology. And so bringing these things together, I think, was a great insight. And so that gives us hope that many other cancer centers could do the same thing. And it's notable over recent years that there are a good number of cancer centers who have very fine programs already in place or are developing new programs that are structured along similar lines.
Supportive care is one piece of the multidisciplinary team. How can clinicians work with supportive care specialists to ensure that patients are receiving all the help they need?
Well, I think it's a two-way street. I think that those of us who are interested in providing supportive oncology services should be very willing to engage in the sharp end of cancer care. And so that we are accessible, we respond quickly, we are part of the comprehensive clinical care team. And building these ideas into, for example, tumor boards, where at a tumor board meeting, not only is radiation oncology represented and medical oncology, but surgical oncology also. So we take a comprehensive view of that person's case and of their management of that particular disease. And then from our colleagues' point of view, whether they're surgical oncologists or medical oncologists, I think there's been a cultural change. People are much more appreciative of the services now, much more understanding of their importance. I think that what we would like to see is early recognition of the patient's needs by our clinician colleagues, so that the supportive oncology services can get in right at the beginning of the illness trajectory, so we can have the greatest impact and the best collaboration with all of our clinical colleagues, irrespective of what their discipline may be.
Ms. Reynolds, some adverse effects include severe nausea and vomiting. What nutritional strategies do you recommend to ensure adequate intake?
As a dietitian, you will probably often hear me say small, frequent meals. So you will hear me say that quite a bit. A lot of times you're not able to eat a volume of food, sit down and eat a regular size meal. So eating a little bit throughout the day will help keep that your nutrition level up. And it may actually help with the nausea. Unlike certain nauseas that you get when you have the flu or food poisoning, you don't feel like eating and you don't want to put anything on your stomach. But having something on your stomach during the nausea and vomiting from chemotherapy can actually help quell some of that nausea. I think of it a lot like pregnancy nausea. I tell women to keep crackers by their bed to eat first thing in the morning to kind of help quell that nausea. It's very similar. So that being said, crackers, dry toast, chicken noodle soup, things that are bland and comforting, things without a lot of smells, because that smell can also trigger that nausea for you. And trying to keep things as simple as possible. And of course, replacing fluids, ginger ale can be helpful. Things, sometimes plain water can be a little bit nauseating. So having something with electrolytes in it, like a Gatorade or a Pedialyte or something like that.
Taste and smell changes are a common adverse effect. What advice do you give to patients to help cope and combat this?
One of the most common taste changes that we see is with one particular chemotherapy that makes a lot of things taste like metal. And in those cases, we recommend using the plastic forks or using chopsticks, eating foods that are frozen versus canned. So getting frozen vegetables and frozen fruits versus canned, drinking a soft drink or something. If you're drinking that, maybe drink it out of a plastic bottle or drink it with a straw so that you're not actually touching that metal. Some of the other taste changes we hear about are things taste very bitter. And so in that case, adding a little bit of sweetness to your food can actually help, even if it's a citrusy type flavor. I think a lot of chicken with orange sauce or beef with orange sauce, something like that will help bring a little bit of sweetness to the food and make it not taste quite so bitter. If something tastes bland, which we get a lot with our radiation patients, if it tastes very bland, instead of adding extra salt, which we know is not very good for you, adding spices, strong spices like oregano. If they can tolerate something spicy, you know, go for a little bit of hot sauce or chili powder or something like that. But if they are having any issues with their mouth or sore mouth or anything, then of course we want to avoid the spicy foods. But all that being said, kind of balancing whatever taste that you're having, balancing it with the opposite. If things are too sweet, balance it with something bitter. If something is too bitter, balance it with something sweet.
Dr. Friedman, your study found that a significant proportion of respondents, including those who have been previously treated for cancer, would decline anti-cancer therapies due to dermatologic adverse effects like hair loss. What are some crucial communication strategies oncologists should employ to address this?
Yeah, I think it starts with setting expectations, but also realistic expectations on both sides of the fence. So I like to say, you know, name the fear first and then right size it. I think often I have patients come into our supportive oncodermatology clinic, never being aware that, for example, the hair loss associated with chemotherapy, and I'm going to highlight chemotherapy, which is different from targeted therapies, whether it be small molecule inhibitors or biologics or immunotherapies. But they were never told that that was actually a possibility that the either hair loss would be permanent or that it, when their hair grew back, it may grow back differently. So I think it starts with setting the stage for success by letting people know what could potentially happen. So it could be a conversation like open with, many patients tell me hair, skin, and nail changes feel as threatening as the cancer, but let's get into what is more likely for your regimen specifically and how do we maybe prevent or manage it. So I think it goes to having those early conversations before therapy starts. I know a lot of cancer center, for example, have these boot camps where they kind of introduce the patient to all those expectations. They get a handbook. And I've seen very often the dermatologic side effect piece is like this big and the book is really this big. So I think it's important to really prepare the patient for what could happen. And, you know, to the point of the side effects that most likely would push someone away from even pursuing treatment, this is actually nothing new.
What should all oncology clinicians know about how to manage mild to moderate dermatologic adverse effects?
Xerosis, retention hyperkeratosis, were like really kind of thick, you know, cracked, itchy, painful skin. First line is going to be proper moisturizer use. So I personally recommend to patients, aside from the million mile wide, you know, aisle of options at a local pharmacy, I do like moisturizers with the indication for eczema on the bottle. It doesn't mean it's just for eczema. What it means is that it falls under the FDA over-the-counter monograph that requires a certain percent of colloidal oatmeal, which is a FDA recognized barrier protectant, but also it has some biological properties and has been studied in this setting to really help repair the skin barrier. That said, aside from that eczema labeling, I do recommend creams or ointments for more cracked, painful, irritable skin. Ointments tend to be a little better tolerated. They don't sting as much as a cream based on what excipients go into them. And when you use these, it's going to be very important. You want to apply these on damp skin to lock water into the stratum corneum where it's needed for proper turnover. Applying to dry skin will have a softening or emollient effect, but it won't really have the biological impact you're looking for when you are moisturizing the skin. Cleaning cleansers, that's another piece. So soaps can really be part of the problem. Traditional soaps are alkaline and our skin is acidic. So if you shift that low pH to a higher pH, which already is starting to happen due to some of these medications, you actually will enable things to fall apart and have barrier disruption, which will be clinically appreciable as dry, flaky skin. So we want fragrance-free, kind of non-soap cleansers, non-surfactant-containing cleansers, and also less is more. You know, scrubbing one's body every day with a harsh soap, that's just going to end in problems. And then other over-the-counter options that are available, low-potency topical steroids like hydrocortisone 1% is available for more inflamed, itchy areas that can be used twice a day, up to 2 weeks or even 3 weeks at a time before needing a break.
In our next section, Daniel C. McFarland spoke with his psycho-oncology colleagues regarding topics of body image, sexual health, and mortality.
With that being said, Michelle, can you provide us with an overview of what body image is, why it's important, and how it influences our patients' mental health?
Body image is really at its core the personal relationship someone has with their own body. It's the way they think, feel, and perceive their bodies and all aspects of their bodies. So it goes beyond physical appearance. It also, you kind of mentioned this before, encompasses functional aspects of the body, sensory experiences of the body. So it's a pretty broad umbrella. And, you know, I've devoted my whole career to just working on this one primary issue in the mental health setting, is to really address the various ways that our adult cancer survivors will struggle with body image and how we can best support them in the oncology setting. So some of that is working as a psychologist, where I will do very focused work with my patients, but a lot of it is also supporting the nurses, the doctors, the physician's assistants as they're working with patients, and this comes up during clinical encounters because it's a pretty pervasive issue, right? I mean, any cancer survivor that goes through treatment is going to have something, they're going to have to adapt to some sort of body image change. It could be big, it could be small, it could be visible, it could be less visible, but it's kind of a universal experience that all of our patients will go through. And we really need to be equipped to identify and help patients through that process because it's pretty universal experience. Now, not everybody struggles to the same degree, but we have to kind of parse that out and figure out what is either being said by the patients directly and listening to that, or maybe what's not being said and how do we get at that? So,
You mentioned language, and could you maybe give us some examples of language you've heard that strikes a chord with you or
sure. I
puts your
mean,
antennae up?
well, sure. I mean, there's always the okay, we have to fix this. What can we do to fix this? Right? There's a lot of that. There's a lot of very inflammatory, difficult language that patients use to describe themselves, as far as being ugly or deformed. Or I have a lot of patients who talk about their breasts. They'll give names to their breasts, right? Franken boob is one that I've actually heard many, many times. And patients are like, oh, I'm not the only one who refers to myself that way. I said, oh no, I've heard that. So there's a lot of that. It's very painful. It evokes a lot of difficult emotions. And so part of it is hearing how they would describe their own bodies. And so I think those would be the best examples I can think of. Is it hideous? Is it ugly? Is it disgusting? Is it, And so some of the work that I do, I just kind of like to throw some things out there for people to think about, is I will ask patients to take a step back and I call them out on their language and I'll repeat it back to them. A big part of it is, would you ever describe your friend this way? Oh no, I would never say that about a friend. Okay, well then why are we saying this about yourself? And then there's also ways where we talk about getting them to shift their language to be less judgmental and more neutral and more objective. So we might get them to describe their body parts. I would say, now I want you to imagine that I don't have the gift of sight. I'm blind. I don't know what ugly or disgusting or horrible is. Tell me what your body actually looks like. Use some language that I can understand. And so shifting that language, you know, these are some cognitive behavioral techniques that you would use to kind of shift people's language and understand that the ways that they're talking about themselves is actually contributing to the body image distress.
To agree that there are differences between men and women and how we should be approaching them and sort of thinking about it very intentionally.
Let's look at men with prostate cancer and actually contrast that a little bit to breast cancer.
Sure.
And so if we think about prostate cancer and breast cancer, you know, there's an argument that actually more men are diagnosed with prostate cancer than women are with breast cancer. You know, I always say it's not a competition, right? We're not looking to be diagnosed more frequently, but I only bring it up to really highlight that, you know, prostate cancer is to men what breast cancer is to women. And if we think about breast cancer and how effective women have been about kind of, you know, raising the awareness of breast cancer and and what that all means in terms of organizing as a community. If a woman has breast cancer and she's interested in talking to other women with breast cancer, she's going to be able to find those women, and that's not going to be particularly difficult. And you know, the notion of what that means for research and what that means for just the focus and understanding of breast cancer. Women have done a fantastic job with that. Prostate cancer is in a different situation, right? Where if you think about prostate cancer and you think like men oftentimes don't want to disclose that they have prostate cancer because what does that mean to a man, right? One is it means, well, first of all, I have cancer in general, number one. And what does that mean with friends? What does that mean related for work? How are people going to treat me? How are they going to view me? But also it's the first hit on manhood,
Absolutely.
right? It's the first hit of, wait a minute, I have
No
cancer.
man wants to self-identify that way, right?
That's
That
right.
this is what I'm dealing with.
That's right. And then if you think about, and this is getting to your questions, right? If you think about then the treatments are how it impacts men and what they're dealing with, right? And so I'm just thinking about prostate cancer. One is so hopefully if a man, well, if man's diagnosed with prostate cancer, hopefully he's not, but if he is, hopefully it's very low grade prostate cancer and they're eligible for active surveillance and they'll be able hopefully then just to watch it and actively surveil it. And so if that happens, the concern is anxiety or depression might impact their decision on choosing active treatment when they don't need to. But then, like, so what happens if a man moves to treatments and you think about what the treatments are? And so the treatments, you know, kind of for early stage prostate cancer, they're essentially radical pelvic treatments. So, and that is either surgery, you remove the prostate, or it's radiation to the prostate. And any radical pelvic treatment is, you know, is going to have significant implications to things like sexual functioning and urinary incontinence or urinary concerns. For men who choose radiation, for most of those men, they're also going to be, that's going to be paired with androgen deprivation therapy, which essentially is hormone therapy, right? It reduces a man's testosterone to zero. Testosterone feeds the prostate cancer. And then any man with late stage prostate cancer is going to be on androgen deprivation therapy or ADT. And so think about what happens in those side effects for men. And so if you think about those radical pelvic treatments, so you're thinking about urinary concerns that could be urgency, leaking, dripping, urinary incontinence. And then it's the sexual functioning, you know, whether that's impacting erections. And then there's, you know, erections are what we hear about most in terms of the impact with sexual functioning. But that's actually not the only thing that happens with sexual functioning.
When you as the oncologist sort of interacting with your patient for whom you've chosen a treatment, when that choice has some ambiguity around it, it's very natural to have a sense of guilt or regret, or I could have done this, or this could have happened in a different
Yes.
way. And how those are obviously our feelings, not the patient's feelings. And that is often, I think, what makes some of these end-of-life conversations difficult for oncologists. I think it's much less difficult when the treatment was very clear. This was, and now it's also more clear about the path forward. Anyway, maybe, I don't know, maybe say something about how oncologists handle those emotions. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
well, I want to talk about emotions or related to
You want
fear
to?
for a
Okay.
second. Yeah.
Good.
I mean, what happens is I think what happens is death, the primary emotion that we end up seeing as psychiatrists or as a psychologist or as oncologists, we tend to see fear, right? And fear takes up all the oxygen in the room. And we think that fear is the only emotion of death, related to death. And emotions and the whole idea of death and the whole idea of the emotions related to death are much more complex than we even think. When we're talking about death, we're talking about not just, we're talking about the period of time that leads up to death. How will I die? Will I be in pain? Will I do that? It's the process leading to dying and needing some reassurance that that can be controlled and I could still, our jobs as human beings is to try to, at some point in our lives, when we become aware of our existence, to create a life and to create a who in the world, to become a person. And at some point, you learn who you are. And then your job is in a world in which you are battered by hundreds and thousands of external events and elections and economies and pandemics and things like that, and internal events like illnesses and cancers and things like that, to try to preserve the essence of who you are despite being battered in all these directions. And so your job is to try to sustain and preserve the essence of who you are. You can put up with losing some parts of it if you can accentuate others, right? But at some point, if you completely lose who you are, then that's when people express to you the sense of like it doesn't feel worthwhile existing, right? And so, as much as possible, to help patients preserve, and that's part of what where meaning-centered psychotherapy is all about, is trying to help patients sustain that sense of meaning that life is still meaningful and worth living through utilizing these sources of meaning. But people are concerned about the process of dying and that taking away the chunks of who they are. People are afraid of the actual moment of dying. Will I die in pain? Will I be struggling for air? Will it be painful to die? And then people are concerned about existence. Will I cease to exist? Will I not cease to exist? So dying is actually more complex than just one thing. Death is not just one thing, it's nothing. I try to reassure my patients. I said, while you're thinking of contemplating about answering which one of those areas you're concerned about, let me just say I'm concerned about all of them. Just a
Well,
normal.
I love the way you put it, that the fear takes up all the oxygen in the
Well, what
room.
happens also is that the fear ends up taking up all the oxygen. So all you see is fear, and that doesn't allow you. And fear is like, because we're human animals and we have these brains that have these ancient primitive areas in our brain, the locus coeruleus is like a burglar alarm. When we were cavemen and women, woke you up in the middle of the night when the woolly mammoth was trying to break in the cave and caused you to run, fear, run, fight or flight response, right? So biologically, we're engineered to be frightened. It's almost like you can't. It's normal. It's built in. It's physiological. It's like your heart rate going up. You can control your heart rate with drugs or meditation or something like that, and we can control fight or flight with medications and or meditation, things like that. But there are so many other emotions connected with death or dying or the idea of being mortal, right? And mortality, your pending mor your mortality and the possibility of death being closer than it was farther away.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.